Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Receiving this message.
We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 248.2C1009, certificate number 54861. Comic Sans.
All right, let's get to work. I feel like we can beat this font. Ah, copper plate, a font for the truly modern man. No, there you are, Verdana. Oh, Comic Sans, you drunk, go home.
Now, I know you care about fonts.
Deeply.
And
I came to it very honestly.
Go on.
I had a desktop publishing software.
Go
in
on.
In 1991.
Sure.
When nobody had it. Like, I think my dad had just bought, like, the first laser printer I had ever seen.
This is pre-proliferation.
Yeah, we just had those dot matrix printers that went zip, 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 and had the holes on the side on the perforated papers.
Yep.
And I was the editor of the high school yearbook, as I think I've said before, and I did not like the typesetting stuff that they were going to do. And so I pretty much laid the whole thing out at home on an Atari ST computer.
Whoa.
And it really was like kind of a discovery of typefaces.
And were they prepared? Did the yearbook use actual type prior to this, movable type?
Yeah, but I think we must have... I don't know if somebody had a Macintosh or if we farmed it out to a print shop.
Yeah, right.
But like home desktop publishing software was brand new.
It would have been.
And I didn't want the whole thing to be in, whatever Times New Roman font it had been in. Because nobody...
Helvetica.
Imagine a world where nobody knows fonts except people in publishing.
Yeah, right. Because that's the world. That was the world.
Yeah, like it was not... There was not a digital... At your disposal, even if you had a personal computer, you know, until the... I don't know, mid to late 90s, you didn't have good font options and ways to print them.
Right.
And so it was
And no awareness of them.
And no, zero awareness. The fact that books were in different fonts, that one book might be in Palatino and the other book might be in Bodoni, like it never occurred to anybody, or at least not to me.
Right.
If you weren't in the trade, you didn't have any idea. And I just remember the first time I realized, you know, Garamond looks really good. Mm-hmm. And... You know, having a favorite font at 17 when nobody else in the world has thought about fonts yet.
Boy, that's really in character.
It's a lonely feeling. But yeah, it really encapsulated my whole future.
Well, I mean, you're describing a moment of awareness about fonts and desktop publishing that really did change the world in a way, because prior to this explosion, there really wasn't even much awareness of graphic design at all. Hardly any awareness on the part of the majority of people that design is even present, and certainly no ability to distinguish good design from bad, because, you know, that is a language, that's an education.
On some level, I guess you could tell, you know, you could see a bumper sticker and be like, boy, they kind of half-assed that, right?
I can't read it, is one, right. But there was,
this looks yet, amateurish, or
there weren't yet a ton of, like, art fonts either. So a lot of that, like, I can't read this because the font is bad, didn't exist either.
Just thinking about, I remember sometimes you'd see TV logos, and I think at one point I realized that the General Hospital logo was the same as some other TV show, or
yeah, you could,
or I'd see like a Capcom video game and realize, hey, that's the Jeopardy Clue font. But except for that, it was just a fleeting moment, and then it was gone. For all I knew, somebody was hand drawing every logo separately.
I mean, it's hard to go back and recall a time, but as we've probably discussed, and it's funny to think about, but in a lot of cultures, there was no distinction between blue and green.
Right.
Until there was then an awareness of it.
That's basically how text was for hundreds of years.
Yeah.
There was, if any serif typeface you saw basically looked like a serif typeface, and you would have not considered that someone had chosen it.
And it was precisely this moment you're describing, the rise of desktop publishing, which was a killer app for computers. That idea that you would buy a home computer.
And you are now a print shop.
Yeah, part of the way it was sold to you is you'll be able to do all of these interesting things.
There was an 80s software application for, I think, Apples and Commodores and maybe PCs called Print Shop. And that was the thing. Like, you can now print out a greeting card at home. You could make a sign for the bake sale. You could maybe even make a banner. And you could choose fonts. I mean, this was very early, and they would not look good because they're going to come out of your dot matrix printer. Right. But you don't need to go to the neighborhood print shop anymore to make signs for the bake sale, because there was a time when you would have to leave the house to print out a flyer.
I had a band, obviously, in the early 90s.
Flyers are very important to you.
And flyers were extremely important. And, you know, sadly for me, at the right when my band started to be at a level that would have justified flyers all over the town, Seattle passed an anti-flyering act that made flyering your band illegal, because it was polluting the phone poles.
It was making the phone poles too thick.
And it was hard for the phone company people to get up the pole, because their pole climbers couldn't penetrate the 9 inches of stapled flyers that were on the poles.
I don't want to skip to the end of the story, but is this law still in effect? I see flyers everywhere.
No. They repealed the law eventually. Oh, okay. But the law was in effect precisely during the time that my band would have been generating.
That it might have gotten somebody to one of your shows.
Well, that, and also just like that I would have a wall in my basement of all the cool flyers of my band, you know, with Jim Woodring drawings on
them. Let's go back and make fake ones.
We should. We should go remember all the shows and make flyers. But at, when I was just starting out, the flyering law hadn't come into effect. And what I would do is find an image, cut it out of a magazine, take a Sharpie and write, you know, Bun Family Players at the Crocodile. And I would, you know, I would triple write the letters to make them stand out in bold. And I'd put $5 or whatever.
And this,
you know,
is just your handwriting?
My handwriting.
You're not trying a thing?
No, I'm trying a thing.
Okay.
Right? Like I would make it kind of, not psychedelic because that would be uncool, but like the B was big and then the L was big or whatever, and kind of draw it. Draw the font. Make my own font.
I'm still very good at that because I came up in the era where you had to hand draw all your own bake sale posters.
Yeah, and I love those. I love doing it. It's really fun for me to do. But I would go down to Kinko's in the middle of the night And I would sit in there and find all their different colored paper and print these out. And I remember distinctly in about 95, somebody saying, you know, that looks really like you're not a pro band, that you're still drawing your flyers with Sharpie. And I was like, oh, it does? And they were like, yeah, like bands now have like cool looking, not hand-drawn flyers.
Like because people had a PC and access to a printer? Or?
I didn't know. I wasn't sure. But at Kinko's, of course, you had, at that point, access to all these other tools yeah. that I was not tech savvy enough to understand. But I do remember somebody telling me, you know, kind of much to my chagrin, that my flyers looked like
amateur.
And I think what I started doing is kind of ransom poster style stuff where I would cut good letters out and
did you have to become a punk band?
Well, no, we weren't punk at all, but this was
you're still doing ransom note,
but you know, and posters, and then go to Kinko's with a glue stick.
Yeah.
But really the mass popularization of this starts with Windows 95. Up until that
point, everybody had an Atari ST or an Amiga.
No.
See, I was 3 years ahead of the curve thanks to the good people at Atari.
And Windows, you know, Windows 95 again, and this was, you remember how Apple used to do this, like, now you can blank, not just make a greeting card, grandma, but you can do, you can make your own movie. And people would go, oh my God, I'm going to make my own movie. And then they'd get in there and it's like, oh, this is hard. This has a learning curve. And it didn't really need my own movie. So never use that again.
But that all changed on the phone where people could say, you could do X. And then it was pretty easy. And now everybody does it.
Yeah, right. It's just like three thumb swipes and you've got a 35 millimeter camera. But Windows 95 came out and it had... it had fonts baked into it, and this software that was designed to be, designed to basically be a desktop publisher. And so people now exploring the idea of desktop publishing, which again was other than band flyers, I didn't need to make my own calendars. I didn't need to make any greeting cards. So the utility of desktop publishing.
You could have.
I mean, I could have.
Right. You could have got really into scrapbooking in the mid-90s.
But what it did was it also introduced into the moment the idea that design was real, accessible.
And accessible.
There was a set of tools that you could learn. And it also was the dawn of graphic art as a major, not as a major in college, because it had always kind of been within an art department, but that this was a job, that you could get a job as a designer, a graphic artist in...
Surely people had those jobs in the past, but nobody knew about it.
Right. I mean, it was in an advertising
agency.
Nobody
knew about the path to it, yeah.
Yeah, advertising used these skills, and also... If you worked at an alternative newspaper... And then if you worked at a publisher, right, you're designing book jackets and so forth. So advertising book jackets and so forth, you know, this type of stuff. But like if you had – most signs were hand-drawn.
Yeah.
And a sign painter was a real job. You were an important character. And all the different sort of design that went into neon lights, that went into the signage of mid-century – motels, and I mean, obviously there was graphic art and graphic design, but it becoming a thing that as an 18-year-old going into college, you would look and say like, well, sociology or comparative history. Oh, what about graphic design?
Remember how much fun we had making those flyers for the concert?
Yeah.
I think it was very seductive because you could, unlike, you know, whatever the video software was, you could pretty quickly dive in and make something professional looking. I mean, not to a trained designer, but like you could have something that looked like a magazine ad in very little time.
Yeah.
And like That's why I did the whole yearbook at home. I wanted to.
Yes.
Like, there was nothing I would have rather been doing my senior year than trying to figure out borders and captions. And
if you think about our introduction to it, a lot of it was through comic books. Mm. And then especially graphic novels, right? Like, now we have a real aesthetic because those really influential mid-80s graphic novels, the birth of this new kind of graphic novel, they hipped us all to, why is this different from Superman? Why is this Batman different from all the other Batmans? You know, is it the bitter herbs or is it the way that the graphics are presented?
It could be the bitter herbs of Lynn Varley's watercolor coloring.
That's exactly right. So and Lichtenstein had already taken comics and made it into fine art, and Warhol had done. You know, like, is a Warhol painting advertising? Yeah. Is it a graphic art?
Does it count as art?
Is it a high art?
When you mentioned comics, I just had a flashback to the fact that I think even before I started to get into typefaces and desktop publishing, I had letterers in superhero comics that I liked and letterers I did not like.
That's right.
I was like, oh, if the guy that lettered X-Men had a really good kind of templatized, very square style that he had used.
Yeah.
And when that guy skipped an issue, I was like, oh,
this
no.
is not how they talk.
This is not how Dazzler talks.
Yeah. Well, there are two comic book letterers that figure into this story. And one of them is Dave Gibbons, who lettered The Watchmen.
Right. He's the artist, but he also lettered it.
Yep. And then John Costanza, who lettered Dark Knight.
He lettered like half of DC's output in the 80s. I have so many John Costanza lettered. Most of the Batman comics, I think, he lettered.
Yeah.
And it's fine. It's workmanlike. It's fast.
Yeah.
It's not the X-Men guy.
No, but it is. But it does have a flavor, and it does. Yeah. And within a thought balloon, it does.
It's a little more angular. There's a kind of handwriting that looks weird in comics for whatever reason, and like, yeah, John Costanza is very close to the Platonic ideal of how superheroes should talk.
Well, so our story, like so many others, does begin at Microsoft.
No,
and it isn't just Windows 95. This was an era, mid-90s, where all personal computing was looking for killer apps. How do we make this not just a popular science nerd dad, you know, home office word processing machine?
Everybody in the family should want a computer.
Yeah, that's right. And because it's going to do all these things that we didn't know we needed done. And Microsoft in 1995 attempted, and you'll probably remember this because you were right in the center of it, but they rolled out a kind of intro to computers called Microsoft Bob.
Oh, I don't remember Bob.
Well, Bob
was Bob what, Clippy?
Bob was kind of had a Clippy energy.
Proto Clippy.
There was a graphical, an 8-bit graphic of an office, like a home office, a shelves and little things you might find in an office. And then you could go around and Bob would walk you through how what you used to find in a home office, now you could use the computer to do. So this is why you would want a computer.
Yeah, he's like a sales guy.
Yeah, because and it's also an instruction, because then Bob would explain how what used to be so hard to do now would be so easy using Bob. Bob was not super popular.
Is Bob in memory hold? Does he look like something?
He looks like, like a little now, dumb smiley face.
I am now binging Microsoft Bob.
Bing Bob.
Oh, I see. The O is a guy.
Bob only lasted for, 9 months.
I hate Bob.
Bob started in March of 95 and by early 96 was gone. Designer Vincent Kinnaire saw that Microsoft Bob had little thought balloons or speaking balloons, but within it, the font was Times New Roman. And he felt, independently of the team developing Bob, hey, this should be more casual because Bob is supposed to appeal to kids and people that are trying to learn computers.
He shouldn't talk to you like a newspaper article.
Yeah, Bob's like got a casual vibe. He's a smiling O with sunglasses on. Like, let's he should have, and very influenced by Dark Knight and Watchmen.
Oh, this guy's a comics nerd?
He's a comics nerd. He said, what it needs is a kind of like casual, kid-friendly font. And he set about to draw a font, but using only his mouse.
Is he not? Does he have a design background? Yeah. Is this his job? Okay.
Yeah, he's a designer.
He's not just some executive who's like, you know, it'd be fun.
No, you know what? He also designed the man in suit levitating emoji. If you go look through your emojis, you'll find that there's a man in a suit but levitating.
Why on earth is there an emoji? There is.
Yeah, man in suit
like
emoji.
It looks like Duke from Doonesbury. Why is this a...
Well, it's one of the things that Vincent Canary did.
Yeah, but Vincent Canary doesn't have the power to just add a emoji.
Well, he does, because he was there. He was there at the...
Oh, he liked ska, so he thought there should be a more ska emoji.
Oh, and he's like pogoing. That's why he's levitating.
It's like a... Yeah.
Yeah. So he sat with his mouse and cursor and basically drew this font with the idea that it was going to be the font for Bob, but Bob, he didn't get it done in time to include it with Bob. So Bob came out, and maybe part of the reason that that Bob failed so miserably is that kids felt really turned off by
Times New Roman.
By Times New Roman was such a drag of a font.
You can just imagine if they'd had the right font on, say, the Vietnam War or something, you know, like really could have changed a lot of people's
minds.
Yeah,
like a friendlier font. Well, we'll see. We'll see that maybe that wouldn't have been the right move. But what the font that he designed became Comic Sans. And do you say Sans?
I believe I already said Sans. So
Comic Sans.
Maybe I said Sans. Comic Sans.
Well, no, I think you might have said Sans. Let's just say both things interchangeably.
I would always say it's a sans serif font. Right.
So let's say Comic Sans. But it rolls off the tongue.
But I think more people do say Comic Sans.
Well, let's say Comic Sans. It'll be one of those things where I say it differently every time. Sanus.
Yeah.
And then you can decide which
way you
say
it. Teach the controversy.
So the first time, so because Microsoft now was leaning into this desktop publishing, they added Comic Sans to their options, their font options. Are you listening to see how it's pronounced?
I'm trying to see if I can find Vincent Canair saying it, because I found him saying his own name, but I can't find Canair himself saying it. Should we try to find just other people saying it?
Well, I bet you they...
Just the name is enough to strike...
I bet you they say...
It was printed in Comic Sans.
Sans?
Well, that guy says Sans. I mean, this is wonderful content. We should just leave all this in.
That is a flowchart about the use of Comic Sans.
He says Sans.
Everybody's saying Sans.
Comic Sans.
Comic Sans.
Or something with a zesty bounce, like Comic Sans italicized.
Comic Sans, even in a British accent.
With menus, yep, that used Comic Sans.
So it's Sans.
I can't find anybody saying Sans.
And, you know, like people were still using Comic Sans and we're not...
It's sans. Do you say...
I guess I might say a sans serif.
Do you say lol or lol?
I always say lol.
All right, let's say sans.
Lol is the sans serif.
Everybody's going with sans.
Everybody was Comic Sans fighting.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hosts. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethosts.com/terms.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
The first time Comic Sans really was included in a Microsoft product was Microsoft 3D Movie Maker, which had a speech balloons component to it. And that was where it first arrived.
I see. You could have speech balloons pop up
as
in the thing you edited. And this was a font that they wouldn't have to pay rights to because a Microsoft guy had come up with it. It's the same reason why Microsoft uses Arial instead of Helvetica. I think, isn't that right? Or did Apple come up with Arial?
Arial was, I think it's Apple, but it was a, it was.
No, it's Windows. I think Apple actually has Helvetica. And
what do I use? I always picked a font that was neither one of those. It was, I didn't like Arial or Arial. I didn't prefer it.
Arial. Her name is Arial.
I forget. I have my computer. Well, I should just look here and see what I have it set at. No, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to continue to talk about Comic Sans.
You know, if you Google other fonts, like I just Googled Garamond and the results come back in Garamond.
Yeah.
Not so Palatino.
So this is something that we both discovered is that if you Google Comic Sans or anything associated with Comic Sans, including Vincent Canary, the returns will all come back in Comic Sans, which terrified me at first because when I first did it and it all came back in Comic Sans, I find it very hard to read. And I thought, oh no, every one of these stories? Is this some terrible joke on Google's part?
Did you think you had some virus now that would make your whole computer Comic Sans forever?
Well, no, because at one point last year or the year before, you know, my daughter's mother slash partner is someone who came up during the graphic art, the explosion of new young graphic artists, and she's in marketing. And so she is part of what we'll soon see was an enormous backlash against Comic Sans. And she hates it, you know, like irrationally. And at a certain point last year, I figured out how I could hack my iPhone to reply to texts in Comic Sans.
I didn't know you could do that.
And it wasn't easy. And she noticed immediately, like I replied to her, like, okay, I'll be there in 5. And she wrote back all caps, like, why is your text in Comic Sans? And I was like, I'm not sure what you mean, you know.
Gaslighting.
I'll be there in 5. And she was like, stop doing that. I don't know how you're doing that. So I did it for a while, but then I couldn't maintain it for whatever reason.
This is my finding, that Google will mimic the font only in the cases, weirdly, of Times New Roman, Comic Sans, and Garamond. It will not do, for example, Verdana, Baskerville, Gill Sans. Maybe we should do a whole show on Eric Gill, because he's the only really top-end typeface designer who also liked to have sex with his dog.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, you really have to separate the artist from the art.
Did Google throw up a little dog emoji that ran across the top of?
He actually designed the businessman kissing a dog emoji.
Well, as you probably know, being a font lover, fonts within the world of publishers and newspaper people, you know, it was a space where you could be trendy, and in the mid-century, there was a whole new way of approaching fonts. A lot of the fonts were old school 19th century fonts.
Yeah, fonts often convey futurity or modernity.
Yeah, Helvetica was developed in 1957 in Switzerland, which is why it's called Helvetica. And it has a very Swiss kind of modernity. And it like it was very fashionable, swept the world. Although 99% of all human, all reading people wouldn't have noticed or right. or made mark of it.
That was kind of the fun when they put out that Helvetica documentary, and it was like, did you ever notice the Microsoft logo is the same as? And I was like, no, I didn't. Even I didn't.
Well, most fonts.
By the way,
yeah, go
we're going to get people annoyed at us because we're saying fonts colloquially, and oh, we know
the difference.
We know what a typeface is, a and we know what a font is, and just go to hell. By the way, if you're complaining about that,
the first argument I got into somebody with about this was 1999, and it was a guy that I knew who was part of this University of Washington new cult of typefaces and fonts that. And my take was predictably conservative in the sense of me saying like, well, this is dumb. Like, this is an unreadable typeface. Why would you use this? Why would you fetishize this? This is a dumb trend.
What kind of thing was he using?
Well, it was, you know, it was one, it, he had like a book of 50,000 unreadable design fonts that for a designer were like, oh, amazing, cool. And it was just like,
well, some of them are good for a logo or a title, but once you set a whole paragraph in them.
Yeah, exactly.
John Darnielle's last book has a full chapter intentionally set in this almost impossible to read kind of old Englishy font because mm-hmm. it's something related to, I think, to a fantasy role playing campaign. And I almost. Couldn't get through it.
Right.
And I told him that just, you know, online, and he was like, yeah, that's what my editor said too. You guys should talk.
In 1982, this is way ahead, and it might seem like way early for this kind of thing, but a guy named Chris Costello was kind of sitting around thinking about typefaces and fonts. And he said, why, like, what I really want is a typeface that looks like English if it were written 2,000 years ago in the Bible. Like, I want to see the Bible, but written in a script that in English that would look like some hand-drawn, not medieval hand-drawn, but like something written on papyrus. And so he worked...
With a papyrus. I see what you're saying.
With a brush and spent months and months designing what you would say papyrus.
Is it papyrus?
Well, you know, between you and me, both things are true. But he developed and designed papyrus or papyrus or proprius.
He developed papyrus?
He was the one who first brought papyrus to America.
That's
and
crazy.
Also he designed the papyrus font.
Which is now such a, you know, there's now such widespread typeface, appreciation.
Yeah. And, or criticism
that there's like a whole, like a viral Saturday Night Live sketch
about
papyrus. Yeah. About whether the Avatar movie should have used papyrus or not.
And Chris Costello sold the rights to this font for $750.
The guy who designed, so basically every, Indian, every Lebanese restaurant.
Yeah.
Every
and the movie Avatar.
Every nature supplement store, every spa.
It got included in the catalog of fonts, and you know, now it's been sold as part of that catalog 1 billion times, and he I think does get a tiny royalty for it.
In general, is most of it work for hire?
In this case, I think he designed it on his own and then sold it for $750 because that seemed like, wow.
But more typically, people just deliver a typeface to their boss and never see a penny again?
The thing that baffled me about it and the reason for the success of Comic Sans is that the first time I was introduced to a pull-down menu that offered you more than 10 choices... was it just burns out your eyeballs.
You never get to H.
Like, how could you possibly make sense of all of these? And so many of them are you know, minor variations. You know, it's Arial plus double plus,
right.
You know, that. And then once you, you know, get into the to it and realize that there's also italic.
And this, by the way, is the difference between font and typeface for people who don't know. Arial is the typeface, the various sizes and variations of it, bold, italic, and so forth. Those are fonts.
Those are different fonts of the typeface.
But and whatever.
So for a lot of people, scrolling down through lists of typefaces, what stuck out to them was Comic Sans.
Because it doesn't look like the others.
It doesn't look like the others. And it looks casual and fun and cartoony. And coming from a world where prior to this, you would have drawn your band flyer with a pen.
It was the only thing that looks like
hand done.
Yeah, like a human hand was there.
And so it was the immediately a popular choice because it conveyed, oh, I just drew this you know, flyer for my garage sale, but it has all of the professionalism of something that was desktop published.
But were people also setting text in that? Were people turning in English papers in Comic Sans?
Well, so the immediate popularity of it meant that it was appearing all kinds of places that, and this was part of the backlash against it, was it's one thing to put out a flyer for your garage sale in Comic Sans, but it was appearing in serious contexts. And in serious contexts, it made no sense at all, right? It is not the font to choose for a resignation letter. It is not the font to choose for an emergency exit sign.
Tombstone?
Or a tombstone. I mean, if tombstone, you know, sky's the limit, right? If you can put a laser etched picture of your dog.
The internet has found many a Comic Sans tombstone, none ironic.
Right. No. And I think the most egregious one example of this is in 2012. In the Netherlands, in the town of Geffen in the Netherlands, they unveiled a World War II memorial that had a list of the names of dead soldiers and dead, you know, victims of World War II in German and English and I think in Hebrew. And the entire the memorial is called Reconciliation. And it's all in Comic Sans.
Do we know why?
Because they felt like it was a very readable font.
It's not.
And after outcry, they, I mean, it was etched in stone, but after some outcry, they cleaned off the Comic Sans and replaced it with another text also in Comic Sans. And the city, the people supporting or erecting the monument really pushed back on the outcry, saying like Comic Sans is just the, you know, it's very accessible.
I don't know. Like, I don't want to drill down into specific letter choices or stroke choices or serif choices, but I don't find it to be a very pleasing font at all, just irrespective of how formal or informal it is. I don't think it's well designed.
Well, here,
I guess the strokes on the I and the capital I and the J are terrible.
Stroke weight is one of the criticisms, and by that, in most well designed fonts, what you have is a modulated weight or a modulated stroke, yes, which is kind of based on what would have been
like a pen nib,
a pen nib, where certain parts of the letter is a thicker line, certain parts is a thinner line, and a well-designed font has, for instance, in the letter E, the letter N, the letter K, I mean, every letter, in a way, the readability of it is that the thicker part conveys the shape, and then the thinner part conveys the detail, mm-hmm, right? The letter E, where it's the loop swings around and connects with the body, the loop has to be thinner at the top and bottom, otherwise it looks awkward.
Yeah.
And then a typeface is typically designed, and you, and I know you're a real nut about this, and a lot of people are, with kerning. And what kerning is the space between letters. And letters within a good typeface are designed so that they fit together. A T and an O fit together more closely than an O and an N.
You're going to hand kern Comic Sans and get rid of some of the problems, but the default kerning is terrible.
The default kerning is terrible. And in order to hand kern it, like, you know, the letter T is not, because a properly kerned font, someone has gone in and tried every combination of two letters and designed how those letters are going to fit with one another. And Comic Sans was not designed that way. So the kerning looks really bad to people who have a discerning eye.
It would be possible to make a very cool, handwritten-looking kind of comic strip-reminiscent font that just wouldn't have the weird problems of the lowercase m and n having those weird verticals, the A being misshapen. When you look at any of the letters up close, it does have the traces of just having been done by a guy on a mouse.
Where
nobody would choose to make the rounded part of the lowercase e that sharp on the inner part, or, you know.
But the mouse at that time did not have a nib emulating.
Yeah.
So what it is it's completely unmodulated. Every line is the same thickness. And what that means is when you draw the letter N and one line kind of overlaps the other, you have these places where the weight is effectively like a line and a half deep.
But the shapes are bad too.
I mean, they're the mouse.
The lowercase s shouldn't have that little thing on the top that's indefensible. I don't know why the A is kind of wiggly.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hosts. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethosts.com/terms.
When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at Remarkable.com today.
So Vincent, because he's, you know, he became somewhat of a celebrity, you know, like a bête noir.
Is this only after Comic Sans becomes famous for being, because it took a while for Comic Sans to become famous for being bad.
And part of that is the rise of younger people who've been educated in the language and culture of graphic art. And part of that, it's true in music, it's true in any art form. Once people know enough about it to have taste, to have developed their own taste, then they're immediately finding things that they wouldn't have otherwise noticed and finding them egregious, right? What architecture, when it was all Greek, was all Greek to people. But modern architecture, then it requires that there be an audience for it that understands the language of it. And then all of a sudden you have all this architecture criticism.
And you're right, but seeing a greater variety of architecture styles or typefaces actually gives you the, even if you don't know the vocabulary, you can still think, well, I can tell you what's not working here.
Yeah.
Because I've seen options. I've seen alternatives.
That's right. And I don't, you know, and I see this and I don't prefer it. And therefore now, you know, I have a critical opinion about it. It's just like, as you were saying, it's just like ska music. Everybody's got a very strong feeling about ska. That might not really be connected to ska at all. Like,
yeah, I almost think Comic Sans is more famous now just for being
self-evidently
bad than any actual use any of it that anyone ever saw of it. Or,
and all of the examples of Comic Sans being bad are examples of it being used in what seems like an inappropriate context, right? It's like, oh, here's a box on a wall for a defibrillator. Probably it shouldn't be written in Comic Sans. But the pushback for it comes from two different and seemingly oppositional schools.
Hmm.
And one of them describes what is called disfluency, meaning that if we get too accustomed to the readability of certain typefaces, the readability of text, it, we're less likely to retain the information as we are when there is some, and we see it in spoken language all the time, the way we use the way we use like, the way we use, you know, that we break up sentences with, well, it's like, so, you know, what that actually does is it introduces disfluency into conversation so that when the important information comes, you're more likely to retain it. That kind of and so forth isn't just in our language because we need time to think. It's part of a subtle linguistic sort of rhythm.
So take that, Toastmasters weirdos that are always policing ums and you knows.
But in typefaces, Comic Sans makes things harder to read and therefore actually increases retention of information.
Oh, there's evidence that there's better comprehension of Comic Sans than other more pleasing typefaces.
When things are set in Comic Sans and then you test on retention, the people that struggled to actually read it had to focus more on the text.
There must be a sweet spot because it can't be that the harder to read a typeface is, the better retention is.
Yeah. I think if somebody's just like, at a certain point you lose them. But then on the opposite side, people with dyslexia find Comic Sans more legible.
Ooh.
So it's easier to read because—
Do we know why?
Well, because the lack of kerning, the lack of modulation.
All the things that have been designed to make other typefaces easier to read are a subtle form of ableism for people who don't have a reading disability.
That's right. And so, and I think people who are working on behalf of dyslexic communities aren't saying everything should be in Comic Sans, but they are saying don't make it a pariah typeface.
Right.
Because it's a...
Because we're fonto-divergent.
Yeah, that's right. And using it can be a way of getting to people who are struggling to read.
Well, I mean, the great thing about digital content is you can just make your Kindle Comic Sans if you're dyslexic.
Right.
And not if you're not.
But as font and typeface and graphic art became things that, you know, the colleges were producing tens of thousands of graphic artists a year who all came out into the world and were working for Vice or using desktop publishing, were putting up websites, and they were all using Papyrus and Comic Sans. It became like a lot of stuff in alternative punk rock culture. It became uncool, and it became not just uncool, but like lame, and then... Well, and we don't say lame. So then it became cringe.
Suboptimal.
It became suboptimal. And by 1999, only 4 years after its introduction, there was already a website called Ban Comic Sans that was put up by a couple, Dave and Holly Combs. And it attracted tons and tons of commentary. There were all sorts of Reddits and so forth about how people hate Comic Sans. It was now a real sign of uncoolness and a sign of out of touchness. It became a grandma font.
What did Kinnaird think about this? Do we know?
He came in for a lot. I mean, he was being interviewed all the time. And what he said was, listen, it was a specific typeface designed for a specific application, which was to be readable by children and to make Microsoft Bob useful as a tool.
Is he like, I also don't think this should be on your term paper.
He said it was never meant to be used to identify a defibrillator in a institution. And so I agree. He famously said something like, if you don't know anything about graphic art, Comic Sans is a terrible font. And if you know a lot about graphic art, Comic Sans is a terrible font. Like, it's not...
But there's an island of people in the middle.
Yeah, right in the middle. Like, if you... It's in this pull-down menu of possible typefaces, not because I intended it to supplant Helvetica, but because it got in there. And people are choosing it because people choose things.
I know that a lot, comic books are all digitally lettered now, trying to get some of that loose handwritten quality. And all the typefaces look better than Comic Sans. I just wonder if there's, is there a good replacement that everyone should be using?
Well, there is. In 2011, Comic Sans Pro came out, which is like a better
it's
Comic
just Sans.
Comic
Sans, but it's $12 a month.
And it also has italics and it has all the different fonts that go along with
but
it.
But it really has a Comic Sans vibe.
It does.
I think what you want is something without that lemonade stand vibe.
But 44% of all teachers surveyed reported using Comic Sans in creating their material, right? They don't use it exclusively, but they do find a use for it in preparing their classroom activities for the year.
Let's give them all a better font.
If you think, and then, I mean, really famously, in July of 2012, when CERN announced the discovery of the Higgs boson, the paper announcing it was written in Comic Sans.
As a joke?
No. And that became then, a big part of this, like, how can you possibly be using this terrible typeface? And after that, CERN did understand it as a joke, and on April Fool's Day, a couple of years later, declared Comic Sans as the official typeface of the of CERN.
Of Higgs boson?
Yeah. Well, no, of the whole enterprise.
I see. Forever and ever.
And so by the 2010s, it was universally reviled. But by the mid-2010s, with the introduction of the beginnings of what became normcore culture, there so quickly, we're only 20 years after its introduction. We're only 10 years after its introduction at this point. There's already ironical use of Comic Sans as a sign of hipster reappropriation.
There are indie rock album covers with Comic Sans?
Well, I mean, if you think the Doge meme, the Shibu Inus are all saying, that's all in Comic Sans. And like Gen Z graphic artists now are making intentionally hard to read bad graphic art as a form of hipster graphic art. You see it all the time. The show bills and advertisements. I mean, still part of alternative culture, but done in papyrus and Comic Sans like unreadable kerning, too many notes, too many words.
I'm looking at classic album covers transposed to Comic Sans. Hail to the Thief is
How does it look?
Is a real keeper, yeah. I think Papyrus is going to be the new Solviet. Nobody's going to give you crap for Solviet anymore.
Because they're going to be mad about Papyrus?
Now that we got Papyrus.
I have always said Papyrus, and I think it's because I first read that word in National Geographic when
I was 10.
Yeah,
you read something when you're 10. You never have to.
8.
When would you have to say it out loud?
Yeah.
Never.
Papyrus. I mean, how often does it come up in conversation?
Never. I mean, the font more than the reeds, probably. Maybe you need to talk about reeds more.
Reeds.
Yeah, we love reeds.
Yeah,
down by the water.
So, do you think that you? I mean, I would guess that you were against Comic Sans in general. Do you think that you could come all the way around to a reappropriation of it and an appreciation of it as an ironic typeface?
No, I think it stays ugly. Even, I mean, if somebody sent me a note in Comic Sans as a joke, I wouldn't be like, come on. You know, I would get the joke.
Right.
But I don't think it ever becomes not ugly. I've been looking for some typeface, like the internet to recommend me handwritten typefaces that kind of have the informal effect of Comic Sans, but are actually not just a terrible abortion. And there's a few, you know, there's
I mean, what does modified Comic Sans look like? Do they add modulation or do they just kern it better?
I mean, these are not attempts to convey. When you try to keep something Comic Sansy about it, you still have everything that's ugly about it.
Right.
That misshapen A, the bad verticals on the M and the N, the little serif on the S and the C for some reason. Whereas if you just start with what, like here's something called Side Note that kind of is a fun, eye-pleasing, slightly handwritten looking font.
Yeah, I see.
But because it's kerned and designed right.
It doesn't look handwritten.
Yeah. I mean it does, but it doesn't, you know? Like Comic Sans is not like handwritten either, I'll tell you that.
No, it doesn't.
And
well, it looks hand moused.
Playpen Sans. This is kind of fun. So there is a world where we don't have to have Comic Sans.
The thing is that in Europe, appreciation of Comic Sans became its own kind of like European.
How is the European take on Comic Sans different from ours?
Well, I mean, the Dutch in particular, I mean, they leaned super into the use of this typeface in their World War II memorials, their Holocaust memorials, I should say. The first Friday of every July has been Comic Sans Day.
In the Netherlands?
It was introduced in the Netherlands, but now it has become globally recognized as Comic Sans Day. And on Comic Sans Day in July, the first Friday of every July, you are meant to only use Comic Sans in all of your correspondence and all of your
EU nanny state. I don't think of the Dutch as elite designers like the Swedish or the Danes.
Do you not? I sure do.
Well, but I'm going to, like, I'm not, I don't think they're on the Scandinavian level, but they do not strike me as, I mean, they strike me as better than us.
Yeah. I mean, their architecture certainly is more interesting.
Oh, yeah. Isn't Rem Koolhaas Dutch? He is,
yes,
right?
Yes, he is. Yeah.
So they should know better.
Well, urban planning. They're really good at urban planning because they're a small nation that should be underwater if God had his way.
Yeah, I would be good at urban planning too if my nation should be underwater.
Yes.
Maybe it's a country that should have no text that would be really good at typeface design.
It's really interesting though because the two communities, the dyslexic support community and the people who are very interested in disfluency as a way of conveying information remain Comic Sans supporters. And the turnaround of it and its embrace by Gen Z graphic artists, and I don't know if you know this, but 1 in 4 members of Gen Z is a graphic artist or a graphic designer.
Like professionally?
Yeah. One in four is a professional graphic designer.
That's crazy.
And what we live in now is a design economy. Everything is double, triple designed because you design it and then—
They're just designing for each other.
Yeah, and your grandma comes in and she's like, well, why don't you make this Comic Sans?
Your clients are all going to be other graphic designers.
In 2019, Dave and Holly Combs changed Ban Comic Sans, their long-running website, to Use Comic Sans.
Whoa.
Yeah.
They've been swayed.
Yes. The Sans is back.
Did they realize it was problematic to call for the banning of a Comic Sans?
Oh, I don't know. Is it? Oh, because it was ableist?
And not for the disfluent and the dyslexic.
No, I think it was much more from a standpoint of like, well, you're against it. And so once the majority is against it, then it's like cargo shorts. It's back, baby.
I just got rid of a pair of cargo shorts, so I did not get the memo.
Oh, wow. What happened?
I just thought, why do I have these?
Why did you ever have them?
That's a good question. That's the same. If I could have answered that, I might have kept them.
Did somebody think, oh, Ken needs to carry half a peanut butter and jelly sandwich in his pocket?
That
all
person
day?
Might have been Ken. It's not clear. Who knows what past Ken did? But I got rid of the cargo shorts.
I mean, they are the Comic Sans of pants.
And that concludes Comic Sans, entry 248.2C1009. Certificate number 54861 in the omnibus. How do you hear Comic Sans in your, like, does it, if you read something in Comic Sans, does it sound like this?
It does. It does. It sounds,
we should have done the whole show in whatever voice.
What are you doing, man? It does. It sounds a little bit like Goofy.
If social media exists in your era, maybe it sounds like Bing Bong and Inside Out. Like Richard Kind talks like Comic Sans.
Bing Bong and Inside Out.
You don't know what I'm saying. I'm just saying random words.
Say what now? Who?
If social media exists in your time, you can find us at Omnibus Project, at Ken Jennings, at John Roderick, respectively, on whatever parts of the internet you frequent. You can always send email, not in Comic Sans. We're going to get so much email in Comic Sans at this point, huh?
Well, because it feels like a single malt scotch that the people that have really strong feelings about it are going to dislike every single thing I said, including that we said font so many times when we meant typeface. Even though you said we know and are doing this consciously.
I just feel like that distinction is maybe valuable in a discussion about different fonts of the same typeface and actually useless in most colloquial contexts.
Are you somebody that believes that saying literally when you mean figuratively are you ready to go all the way to...
I think most people, when they use literally, they're not actually using it to mean figuratively. That's like a misstatement of the colloquial. Using it to mean actually.
But they're saying like, it literally killed me to see you.
Yes.
And so it's...
But they're not using it to mean figuratively. They're using it to mean actually. But it is often in a figurative...
It becomes figurative, right? Or to say like, but that begs the question.
But like people use it, like people often just use it in a way that's not figurative. Like this room is literally all red. And you would say that about a room that actually was all red.
Right.
I mean, but that's, so literally is not right there, but they're just using it to mean
it's not wrong.
Really.
Yeah. Yeah. They use it to mean really.
Begs the question.
How do you feel about begs the question?
I mean, nobody actually needs the real usage of begs the question.
It's true.
It's like it's a very specific fallacy that rarely comes up in conversation.
Yeah.
But there's no reason not to say raises the question, which is actually clearer.
But it's an extra syllable and a half.
It's true. Think of what you could be doing in that time. Buying cargo shorts. Uh-huh. Like there's lots. Like you're losing so much time if you say raises the question.
I guess begs also has an S half syllable, so it's really only one extra syllable.
Begs is like Gollum.
It begs. Begs is the question.
Begs is the question, precious. I'm not. I tend to be a little more descriptive than prescriptive, especially because a lot of the things that people tend to enforce are wrong or at least old. Like. Because in my technical context, you would never use these two words. What was the one we had? Poisonous and venom. You would never say a spider was poisonous. That means if you eat it, you die. Well, no, not for the rest of us. Like, yeah. I'm glad your toxicology lab maintains that distinction. And please continue to do so. But please leave the rest of us alone.
But what are some of the other things that people are going to write us angry letters about as regards Comic Sans, our treatment of it.
I think we're okay.
Yeah, all right.
No, the stakes are very low.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, that's what I thought about single malt scotch, but we lost so many, like, 280-pound, like, bearded muscle men.
That was our main demographic.
It was. They were like, oh, I can't support the show anymore.
Did you notice how all our advertisers used to be kilts, and now they're not? I think I said the, did I say the email address?
I'm not sure. Why not say it again, but say it in Comic Sans.
Let's just leave it as a suspenseful. The Omnibus Project at gmail.com. You can send physical items to PO Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington, 98155. Here's another great beginning of a postcard, just like last week. This booklet belonged to my great uncle.
What booklet?
It's a postcard from Svalbard,
But is Norway? There a booklet with it?
There is, and you're going to love it. My brother and I both listened to your show and thought it may be of interest.
The Alaskan Quake booklet.
And it's in great condition. Like, look, it's still every page shiny. The corners are good. The staples are tight.
If I leave it out, of course, my daughter will thrash it within hours.
But it's beautiful. And it is kind of a design gore thing. Like, it's clear that this was made by a little shop that didn't have access to all the the newest or most...
Oh, this is a nice shape.
The most discerning eye.
You don't think that this is really well designed here?
Earthquake Epic Center. That should be your ransom font on your.
Where they cut up a typeface.
If your band had been called the Western State Earthquakes, then you could have used pretty much anything in here.
Should have done.
Thank you so much, Anne. Oh, who supports the show on Patreon? Speaking of which, let me recommend that you all follow Anne Regan's footsteps. First of all, send us a beautiful mint condition booklet about the Alaska earthquake of 60. You should know this.
I do know it.
I don't.
Do you not?
60, let me guess.
It's the Good Friday earthquake of 19...
66.
No, 64, I'm afraid. You were close, though.
Actual retail price of the earthquake, 1964. I overbid. But the other thing you can do that Anne does is go to patreon.com/omnibusproject and see all the amazing perks and extra content and early content that can be yours for the low, low price of like $1 a week.
I think. It's got to be $5. Sorry.
No, $1 a week.
Oh, $1 a week. Yeah. $1 and a quarter a week.
So you think about it. Well, a month is more than $4.
Sometimes.
Except for February, always. 11 out of 12 months surveyed are 4.5 weeks.
Yeah,
right?
I see what you're saying.
So for $1.20 a week?
Yeah. $1.15, $17. $1.17 a week.
For pocket change is what I'm saying. You could have 50 new omnibuses. And if you're somebody who just got 600 omnibuses for free, you're right. That's a little more. But it's worth it. It's worth it, is what I'm saying.
No, I agree. I mean, you're preaching to the choir here. Sign up for the Patreon.
I guess, is there any way we can... we have a new website. Is there any way we can put this episode in Comic Sans on our website?
You are the one that can answer that question. You're asking that rhetorically.
I am. And I'm going to ask somebody who can actually answer it. Like maybe Mark.
Yeah. Hey, Mark, can we do that? Our new website. Which is... OmnibusProject.com.
It's still OmnibusProject.com. It just doesn't redirect to the old Fireside site anymore.
Good man.
Which means it's being updated with new shows for a change, because it turns out we had people listening on the web.
We had a lot of people listening on the web. We were very surprised to hear from everybody.
I guess we did a full show about Winamp that people love, so we should not be surprised that many of our users listen to podcasts in a web browser in 2024.
Futurelings, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We hope and pray that the catastrophe that we fear may never come. But if the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may have been our final word. But providence allows, we wish you many goods and cheese and hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.